they say hombre, hold another bottle. Look a little closer, cigar in Moscato. An actor in improv coming from Chicago. Alto, make way for Paul Alto.
Brando, Brando. Welcome everyone to Paul's Bottle Presents. Gang, it's a party. And I'm in July. My very special guest today is Will Luera. Unless you're white, then it's Will Luera.
That's exactly right. You got it. Thank you for getting both pronunciations correct.
We're going to give both pronunciations. Is Will a Latino name?
My father's also William. My grandfather just really liked the name, like the English version of it, William. And my grandfather really liked it. Then my father liked it. My brothers have more traditional Mexican names. So like my younger brother is Juan Alejandro. And my youngest brother is Alfredo Ricardo. And I was just William, no middle name, just William. That's it.
I know it's a stereotype, but I'm surprised that your brothers only have the three names, just one middle name. I also do not have a middle name. My real name is Paul Rodriguez, but I don't have a middle name.
Wow.
Which is strange. No way.
That is strange. Yeah. You're one of the few people other than myself that I know, especially among Latinos. Yeah.
What was your grandfather's name?
He was Juan Mendoza Luera. He took on his mother's last name, became his middle name.
Which I think, isn't that the way we're supposed to do it, where you take the mother's maiden name and then your last name?
Yes.
And then once you start adding middle names, that's how we end up with all those stereotypes. We've got like six names.
Yeah. And I've got some cousins like that, especially my cousins that are in Mexico. They still very much have that, just name upon name.
Wait, your family's from Mexico?
Yes.
How the heck did you end up in Florida? Did you convert to Cubanism or what?
I got recruited into Cubanism. That's correct. What got me eventually to Florida was a job. The full-time, the full-salary improv jobs are few and far between. And there was a theater down here, not an improv theater, just a like an equity house that had an improv stage. And they wanted somebody to run it for them. It was created by the managing director of the theater. She's the one who started the whole thing. But she was like, I can't do this anymore. And she brought me in full-time. And I moved down from Boston. So yeah, that's what brought me here. Yes, but there are a lot of Cubans here. And so I've learned to really appreciate the culture.
Sure. How far
south in Miami?
How far south in Miami are you? How far south in Florida are you?
Like from Miami, from here?
I was just trying to find out where you were in Florida.
Gotcha. Basically, it's on the Gulf side. So we're like not on the Atlantic Ocean. We're on the Gulf side. And we're about 3 hours north of Miami if you head up the Gulf.
Got it.
Yeah. There's Orlando right in the middle. Then we're a little bit more. We're to the west of that.
I used to travel a lot to Sarasota. My friend's father lived in Bradenton. I think it was Bradenton. And we go to Siesta Key, Soda.
That's exactly where I am in Florida. I am in Sarasota.
Really? Okay. I need your address so that when I come visit, I have a place to stay.
Please. Yeah. It's so funny that you say that because very few people pass through Sarasota. There's all these other big cities. So the fact that you've been here, that's awesome.
I love it. Recently, though, because I'm working with a brand called Owl and their headquarters are in Boca. It's on the other side. So I've been there a couple times to visit and to do a trade show and a TEDx event and all this. I'm liking Florida a lot. I know people are definitely moving there.
Yeah, I know that it has its reputations and stuff like that. It's a big state. There's just a lot of different people here. I feel very lucky. The Sarasota area, this little corner of Florida is really cool. I feel very lucky to live here.
It's a great area. I remember, I think Siesta Key was one of the nicest beaches maybe in the U.S.
True. Yeah, I always tell people, I'm like, we're number one or something here is number two beach in America. And I tell people, I'm like, that includes Hawaii. Like, we're beating out the Hawaiian beaches. So we're up there.
That's amazing. We had already a couple questions or comments from the peanut gallery of the audience. Chris wanted to know, ¿por qué no Guillermo? Why not Guillermo?
It's a great question. I wish it was Guillermo. And when I go back to Mexico, they call me Guillermo. And they'll call me Guillermo, or what would be the Will equivalent of Guillermo is Memo. So when I'm in Mexico, they'll call me Memo.
Yeah, instead of Will.
Instead of Will, yeah.
Yeah, Will.
Yeah.
I am a junior, and they used to call me Junior. Of course, then my brother wouldn't let me live that down.
And there was this little fat cartoon character named Ñoño from Chavo del Ocho or something. So they started calling me Ñoño.
Oh, man.
Not good memories of traveling to Mexico in the middle of August when it was so damn hot. And it felt like my father would kidnap us. Like, we're kidnap victims. He would throw us in a van. He would drive like a madman from Chicago, the Chicagoland area. And I think he'd almost make it as far as Texas. I mean, Texas is so big, it takes a whole day. So I feel like we make it almost to the north of Texas, sleep there. And my mom would have to pack food, and she was feeding him as he's driving. And we'd make it in like a couple days. I think we spent an extra day in McAllen, Texas, where my grandmother had a house to help her fix it up and things like that. I just remember these very hot Mexican summers.
It was miserable for a
I feel like it almost sounds like our parents were, our families were on like the same migration trails, because my family was from Chicago area originally, and we would do that drive, the one that you're talking about. As you described it, as soon as you said we would stop at, I'm like, I remember those stops in northern Texas. Eventually, over the years, Hope, Arkansas became like a stop. We knew that we were going to stop or stay at Hope, Arkansas. I don't know why that always became a thing. And then we would do the McAllen stop also. I also have extended family in that area. Now I still have family there, yeah.
Very interesting. Let's figure this out, because we're probably related. My mom was born in Harlingen and then kind of raised in McAllen, and then somehow went to Ohio and then went over to Chicago. And that's where she met my father, like in the 60s. She met him on that first day. I think she still kicks herself for hooking up with him.
Where would you guys go in Mexico?
Would you guys go to Monterrey? Because that's where my father's family was.
Stop it, man. Yeah, that's where we would go. You say Harlingen, and I know we have extended family in Harlingen. I hear the name of that place a lot when my family talks about it, like Harlingen and McAllen and all that. My father went up through Texas, and the funny thing about my father is that he was born in the United States when my grandfather was migrating when he was part of the Bracero program. My father was born in McAllen and then eventually came back to the U.S., moved to L.A., and then ended up in Chicago. My mother came on a student visa straight to Chicago, and then that's where they met. Probably very similar story as yours. My mother is the one that's from Monterrey, actually from a little town outside of Monterrey.
Dr. Gonzalez.
Not Dr. Gonzalez, no. Oh, that would have been. No, you've probably driven through her town. If you were driving down to Monterrey through Laredo, I imagine you passed through Laredo maybe sometimes.
McAllen and Reynosa.
No. If you ever came through Laredo, you hit a little town called Cienega de Flores, which is outside of Monterrey. It's like on your way to Monterrey, but it's through the Laredo Pass.
Got it. It's all so close. Have you done your DNA or have you done like your ancestry DNA?
I have.
That is that migration pattern of our people. It was exactly what I thought. You're like 63% Spanish, 30% Native American, but it was exactly that. Here's where your family's all. And it was Monterrey, and then Texas. Some of us, when they said run for the border, they didn't mean almost make it all the way up to Canada. My God.
I remember before social media, before all this 23andMe and ancestry, my family would say, oh yeah, we've got extended family up in Oregon and Washington. Like it would keep talking about this family. And then Facebook starts opening up and I start connecting with all this family up in that corner. And then I get on Ancestry and I look up my grandfather, and then you start to see all the documents, all the immigration documents. And you're like seeing, oh, wow, like they used to just follow the picking seasons all the way up there. And then they would just work all the way down. And similar to you, I am like 50% like Native. Then it's 30 to 40, 35% of Iberian Peninsula, like Spain and all that. And then I'm like all over the world. After that, it's Arabic, it's Northern Africa, it's Southeast Asia. I'm like, wow, they put me together. I'm quite a mix.
Very similar. I even saw, and it could be zero because it was like 1%, but like Welsh. I was like, how the heck does that happen? For me, what was sad was 0% Asian, because I have Asian.
Yeah.
I must be some kind of Asian, but no, zero. And it was a little heartbreaking because I have this Asian soul or Asian spirit. Maybe just because I like a dim sum. I don't know. No.
I think the only three parts of the world that didn't show up on my map were Russia, India, and Australia. Everything else I had like DNA scattered everywhere.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. But that was also, of course, so there is that Arabic influence when the Moors were in Spain at the Iberian Peninsula and all that. Chris also said that on Fireside, we find out that we are long lost brothers.
We got to just keep digging and then we're eventually going to be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Where did you grow up in the Chicagoland area? I grew up in Aurora.
Okay. I grew up in Little Village is where like my initial like upbringing. So on the west side, like right off of 26th Street. I always tell folks like that we did the reverse white flight. Like when I was in fourth grade, we moved to the suburbs. We moved to Burbank, south of Ford City, up that way. We moved to Burbank for a couple of years. I always tell folks for those 2 years, I became Bill. And not because I wanted to, but that's what everybody just kept calling me.
Oh.
I came in. I'm like, my name's William Luera. And they're like, okay. I never even heard of Bill. I'm like, oh, okay. I call it reverse white flight. It's because we were there for 2 years and we just couldn't make it work. And it had nothing to do with the people. I had great friends. We had good neighbors. It just wasn't our vibe. It was too quiet. And so we ended up moving back to the inner city, which was still a pretty ghetto back then. We moved into Pilsen. And then that was my formative years, like middle school through high school.
Around what year would this have been?
This would have been from 1986. Yeah, 1986 is when we moved back to Pilsen. And then I was there until 1992.
So that would have been like your high school years and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah. In Chicago, in Pilsen. I didn't experience Pilsen until later on when we started doing improv there. It would have been like 97, 98, maybe 99, because that's where we put South Station together. And yeah. Pilsen is where we were doing one show on a Friday and one show on a Saturday. Second City in Old Town in Chicago, probably on Saturday nights, and in Pilsen on Friday nights. It was quite the experience. It was wonderful to see this community, but I think it was maybe even starting to get gentrified.
Late 90s, it was starting up. Yeah, I was already in college. Or I was out of college by then, but I would be coming back. I remember the first time I saw a barbecue place. Everything was Mexican. And then you see a barbecue place and you're like, wait a minute, one of these things is not like the other. All right. And then you see a gastropub and I'm like, wow, okay, now Pilsen's changing.
Yeah, it certainly is. Coffee shops, fancy coffee shops. Where did you go to school?
I went to St. Ignatius College Prep.
And then to college?
Oh, then to college, I went to Boston College.
So that's how you ended up in Boston.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved Chicago, but I definitely needed to spread my wings. I needed some space for my parents. So I applied to so many schools as far away as possible. And Boston was one of the best.
You needed a little bit more racism in your life, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. I got that lesson right away, man. The first couple of years in Boston.
I'll bet. We're going to have to do a whole show on that. I was quite the opposite. I applied to one school, and for some reason, I'm like, if I don't get in, then I guess I just won't go to college. And that was the University of Illinois, and then 3 hours away from my parents, so that once a month I could come home and drop my laundry off, get it done, and then go back to school.
You said in Champaign-Urbana?
Champaign-Urbana, yeah.
That was on my list. You won't believe it. Once again, our paths almost crossing. Although, I don't know what years you were in school. It got so far for me. I had a dorm picked out in Champaign-Urbana. Like, I was going to go. And then BC sent me an acceptance letter. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I guess that's where I'm going now.
Did you just fly out? Because for me, my dad just drove me down. It was only 3.5 hours away. But did you just then have to fly out to Boston or did you drive cross country? It's not that far from Chicago.
The application part was blind. Like, we did not know. I knew nothing about Boston. I knew nothing about the school. I just liked what they offered. So the first time I went there, we flew out. That was my first week of school.
Got it. What did you end up studying?
I studied physics and computer science. That was my double major.
Jesus.
Yeah. I did that. I lived in that world. I lived in the physics computer science world for about 17 years before I got the job here in Florida.
So how long have you been in Florida now?
It'll be 8 years in November.
Got it. Wow. Are you using your physics degree in the world of theater?
I think a lot of what I teach in improv was very, especially early on when I was becoming a teacher, it was very influenced by what I had learned in physics. A lot of the way that I saw the improv stage was influenced by that.
Wow. That is very interesting. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to ask a snarky question, but I think we're getting somewhere. Isn't that amazing though? How physics is in the world, but improv the way you can relate improv to a lot of things where you wouldn't think so, but you sure can.
Yeah. It's actually happening to me again right now with a whole other discipline, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. I was learning physics and improv in college. Like, both were happening simultaneously. And I'm doing this action because I feel like those two parts of my brain were just like rubbing up against one another. The example I often give, one of the more mainstream examples that we all look at, we all at least have heard of the idea of Schrodinger's cat, or know a little bit about what the idea of Schrodinger's cat, right? Like, the whole theory being that if you put a cat with a radioactive device inside of a box and you close the box, and then up until the point, and I'm really simplifying this experiment, but basically up until the point that you open the box, the cat is both simultaneously dead or alive. It's both until you verify with your eyes, and then you say, oh, the cat is dead. Then the reality of the cat being alive, that reality is gone. Now we're focusing on the cat being dead. So how does that apply to an improv stage? When I used to teach early improv, I'm like, the blank stage of an improv scene, it could be anything. It is all possibilities at once. All possibilities exist on the improv stage at once until somebody says, this is what it is. Until somebody says, we're at the Grand Canyon, we're at the dentist's office, we're on a first date, et cetera. Up until that point, it could be anything, but you have to observe that one reality. And so anyways, that's how my nerdy brain brought these two ideas together. And I teach a lot from that, from like, anything is possible in an improv stage. Once you know what it is, you have to tell everybody, this is what I see. And then everybody will see it with you.
That is such a great way to look at it. Yeah. Well, yeah. Round of applause. That is such a great way to look at an improv stage. And you're right. You have to let people know. Del Close used to teach us, it was okay to take a second and look at all the possibilities and then pick the most interesting one. And I feel like that's almost similar to that, where you've got this world of possibilities out there. Which one are you going to choose? But now you have to let everyone know what you've chosen, whether it's by object work or action or whatever. But that is such a great way to combine the two. This is one of the methods that you would use to teach?
Yeah, exactly. Then you would start to hear like what you just mentioned about Del Close, and it made me feel better. I was a young teacher trying to make sense of the improv I was learning, and I was using what I knew, which was physics. That started to just help me. It helped me understand it and helped me communicate it. But then folks would tell me there's other teachers that are saying very similar things to you. And that just helped me feel validated. I'm like, okay, at least I'm onto something that is, at least I'm not crazy in the way that I'm seeing this stuff.
No, that's wonderful.
And to this day, it helps me teach it. Sorry, go ahead.
It's whatever helps you teach it, but you're also helping some students understand it that maybe are more linear thinking and thinking about physics and have that part of the brain working where you can actually relate to them with your style of teaching improv.
I think you're right. And I think it has helped. It has helped me teach it and reach people in different ways. And it's helped me understand it a bit more. I feel like my teaching right now is going through a whole other evolution because now I became a CrossFit coach. So a whole other cult, not the improv cult, but the fitness cult of CrossFit. I became a trainer, and the way we coach CrossFit is now starting to influence the way that I coach improv. It made me realize like some blind spots in my teaching that I could be better at. Once again, this action is happening where these two parts are bumping up against one another.
It's funny that you would say that, because when I got into yoga, the same thing started happening where you start looking at improv like you do yoga. It helps each other because you're supposed to be in the moment when you're doing improv. You're supposed to be in the moment, listening and things like that. And yoga is very similar, where you're supposed to be in the moment, not thinking about the past, not thinking about the future, where you want to go, but rather enjoying this moment that we're in. I think improv is very similar to that. Worst case scenario, you can always come back to the Chicagoland area and work at Fermilab.
I did an internship there my senior year of high school.
I worked there also because my father was one of the first hires. And whenever they opened, maybe like within that first year, he used to work at a place called Clark Equipment. It was called Austin Western first, I think. He had a factory job. They built forklifts and he was a foreman. And then they were going to close. So they said, Pablo, you need to go grab another job, because he was already older. He had me when he was like in his 40s. So he was already like in his 50s then. And they're like, hey, we're going to close. So you should probably go get another job. A guy that used to work for him was now in charge of hiring at Fermilab. They're like, hey, we would love to have you here. That's when they were building the magnets for their collider. He ended up working there. He and this other guy who was like 23, they're like, yeah, we'll do this for like 6 months until our factory closes. Now we've got jobs. Another company, Clark Equipment, came in and bought the forklift factory. Oh. So they didn't close for another 10 years. My dad worked 2 8-hour jobs. First shift was at Austin Western, which he'd walk at the end of our block. So he'd walk there, walk back. My mom would have lunch for him. He would pick it up. He would then drive a carpool to Fermilab and put in another 8 hours. So I didn't really grow up with my dad because growing up, he was just the guy that was around on the weekends working, still working on one of our houses or mowing the lawns or shoveling snow. So I don't know how he did it because I had to get up early just to do this interview. And I'll be honest with you, I'm exhausted already.
Oh, man. But isn't that something like you're giving me as you go through that story? You're like, so many things are just packed into my brain. Like, you're making me think about like how hard my father and a lot of my male relatives, how hard they work. And you made me think about this one summer in college where I worked, say, very similarly. I had to put in 2 full-time jobs at the same time over summer. It was only over summer, not over however long your dad did. It sounds like almost 10 years. Yeah. Then it suddenly, that cascade of thoughts makes me think of like the horrible stereotype of Latinos and immigrants of being lazy. I always tell people, I'm like, the reason why you think they're lazy is because whenever you might catch a glimpse of a Latino resting, it's because they're probably in between jobs. It's like the only time they could rest.
That's it. I was so pissed. Yesterday, I slept right through my siesta. I was so upset.
That's funny.
Thanks. I'm working on that vid.
I just did stand up for the first time last week, like an actual show. Like, I've done open mics before, but I did my first set last week.
We need to talk. I've done it a handful of times. I'm almost thinking about maybe just doing a one-person show so there's not that pressure of stand-up comedy.
Do you think
knowing improv and having an improv background helped you with your stand-up?
This is where I know it helped me. The reason why I did it was because I was part of a class that kind of led up to this actual like big performance. And the one advantage I had was stage presence. So the fact that you're already used to being in front of an audience, like that was one advantage I had. Number two was we already know what's funny. Even if we haven't crafted the joke yet, we kind of have an idea of what makes something funny and maybe even what is out of bounds, like what you shouldn't be. I was able to put together the skeleton of my set pretty quickly, where a lot of my classmates were struggling with like just zeroing in on something that was funny. They were just shotgunning a bunch of ideas and some were really offensive. Some just weren't funny. I think at least as improvisers, you have an idea of where those boundaries are.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. Good. And I'm sorry, was this part of a class that you were taking or why did you have to do the stand-up?
Yeah, so there's a stand-up club here that offers these classes, and then they put you up on the main show. You'll go up, like your graduation show is part of a main show, and like on a prime night at a prime time. And so again, it was like I've done open mics before where I've just been like, hey, here's some dumb ideas I've had. But then this one, it's like they actually coached through into crafting an actual set. So yeah, it was part of this class.
Oh, wonderful. Congratulations, because it's not an easy thing to do.
It was scary, but I enjoyed that fear. I miss it sometimes.
Oh, wonderful. And you'll be doing it again, I take it.
Yes. Yeah. Now that I have a set, this one, it ended up being 5 minutes, but it was in class before I had to cut it down. It was a pretty solid 10-minute set. So I know I could do that and I could do that well. Now that I have a better sense of how to craft a set, I'd like to try it again. There is an artistry to it. There is an artistry of weaving these jokes and these punchlines and the timing behind it. There's an artistry that you appreciate.
Wow. Wonderful. Yeah. Who are some of your favorite stand-up comedians, either from now or from the past?
I think like right now, I'm really enjoying Bill Burr right now. And I don't know if it's that Boston thing that kind of... Sure. There's a woman that I know that and used to perform with. I find her stand-up very funny. I say all that because it might sound like I'm playing favorites, but I think she's great. Her name is Jen Kirkman. She has a few Netflix specials.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Then the rest are, there's some names now that I've enjoyed, but they're like hot topics right now that you have to be careful with. I have found like some of Chappelle's stuff to be brilliant and some of Louis C.K.'s and Aziz Ansari. Of course, they've all now have had moments where they've had to go through their own evolution and are still going, in some cases, still going through that evolution. John Mulaney's been a lot of fun as well. I believe he's a Chicagoan, if I'm not mistaken. My original one, I look back at like 80s. I don't know if you remember Robert Townsend from like the 80s and 90s.
Sure.
I remember Robert Townsend and early Andrew Dice Clay were very formative for me.
He's still out there touring. And
he's coming to Sarasota in a couple months. Yeah.
Oh, man. You're going to have to go check him out.
I need to try to get tickets to that. Yeah.
It's refreshing sometimes to see. He's been around for a while, but he's starting to hit it big, which is Mark Norman.
Yes.
He is unapologetic. I think it's refreshing when people like Joey Diaz, you can't cancel them because they don't care. And that's their thing. And they're funny. And I think that's it. If it's funny first, then it's okay. Sometimes as satirists, as comedians, we should be allowed that little extra step because sometimes you're just trying stuff out and see if it works. I'm a big fan of Tom Segura.
Yes.
Sebastian Maniscalco, another Chicago guy.
Wow. Yeah, these are all great names. You got me like thinking now.
Natasha Jero, Christina P, Tom Segura's wife.
Yeah.
I worked on Sarah Silverman's show.
Oh, yeah. Another brilliant one. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. I think we're in good company. And I love the fact now that I think thanks to Joe Rogan, a lot of these comedians are now smoking cigars. I guess I got to work that angle. Become the official supplier to
Canadian.
Bought those cigars.
There it is. I see it on the screen right behind you.
There it is. Perfect timing. Cool.
That was, was that really, that wasn't your doing? That just came up at the right time?
It just came up. It frowned.
It's like the moment you said it, it like popped up. It was great.
That is too funny. No, it's just on a loop, different photos from my life. That's it. So if you want to start smoking, you let me know.
It wouldn't be a start for me, next time I go to Vegas, I need to check it out. Even though it wouldn't be a start for me, I am blind to the landscape of it. I'll walk into a cigar shop. I don't know what to look for, et cetera. I imagine that it's as complicated as like the landscape of beer drinking or wine drinking or something like that, where there's a lot of variation there.
You know what? That's exactly it. Somebody just texted me that they're watching. So hello, Vaughn Papa Nicholas of Chicago. It's also like the coffee business. He's in the coffee business. It's anything that's handcrafted that comes from the earth. So it's very linear, very similar to handcrafted beer and wine. Cigars are the same way because it comes from the earth. It's all natural. It's crafted by hand. If you start putting chemicals into it, it changes the flavor, things like that. They're like little pieces of artwork that have been touched by 400 pairs of hands from the time that the seeds were planted all the way till the salesman hands it to you and takes the wrapper off and cuts it, and then you smoke it. So there's this kind of romantic side to it. It's in the world of tobacco, which if there was no tobacco, there'd be no USA. Our first crops in Jamestown were.
That's beautiful, man.
You have any Vegas stories? Do you have any good?
I do have one. It's crazy, but not like in a hangover kind of way, like the movie. But it is crazy. It's actually a great Vegas story in that there was one year in my improv career, this is about 4 years ago, where I was, I think for 10 consecutive weekends, I was away from the house. Very like the inverse of what your father was going through. Every weekend I had to go fly somewhere, teach somewhere. I was gone. After the last weekend, I told my wife, I'm like, hey, listen, what are you doing this weekend in October? Are you available? And then she's, yes. I'm like, block it off. We're going to go do something. I didn't tell her what it was. The weekend comes around and I just told her, I'm like, listen, tomorrow morning, this was Saturday night. I told her, okay, tomorrow morning, Sunday at 4 a.m., we're leaving the house and you got to pack a bag. I need you to pack a swimsuit, comfortable clothing, a fancy outfit, and maybe a second comfortable outfit. We're going to leave with one of the comfortable outfits. She's like, okay. 4 a.m. comes around, our babysitter arrives, and my wife is like, why is the babysitter at 4 a.m.? I'm like, don't worry about it. Babysitter comes in, we leave. She still has no idea where we're going. We're driving for an hour. She notices we're driving towards Tampa. Still has no idea where we're going. Now she's noticing we're going into the airport. She has no idea where we're going. It wasn't until we walk up to the plane that she sees we're going to Vegas. We fly to Vegas. We arrive at 10:30 in the morning, immediately check into the Luxor. We basically just leave our bags. My wife then hits this other gear that I've never seen. My wife, she's Brazilian, so she's also an immigrant, but she's pretty reserved. But then, like, we literally put our bags out in the Luxor, and then suddenly something happened. And she's like, let's go. And I'm like, oh, okay. We go down to the lobby of the Luxor. We start doing things there, and we walk out. We walk straight to New York. Literally, for the next 8 hours, she gets a tattoo. Like, we're doing all these things, and we're like... For 8 hours, we're just like enjoying the strip. But the reason why we went to Vegas is because I made dinner reservations at in the Cosmopolitan. And that was the whole purpose of the trip, was that dinner. So at 6 o'clock at night, we go there to have our dinner. We finish by around 8 or 9, walk more of the strip, and our flight is that same night. But remember, we got there at 10 in the morning. Our flight is at 12:30 after midnight that same day. It was an insane day in Vegas.
Oh, my God. So, and you don't have to answer this question, but I would like to know, was it like $700 for the two of you for dinner, or did you have wine and it was more like $1,000?
You, man, you did the math right on. It was $700 for the dinner. When I made the reservations, I did not pay for the wine. I'm like, oh, this is already so much. But then you walk in. And you're just seeing everything. And they give you like one last chance. Like the sommelier is there and is like, for $150, you could do the pairings. And I was just like, oh man, all right, fine. We'll do that as well. And it's $150 each. And that got us to about 1,000.
Man, that is a tough nut to crack. I've eaten at Haleo. And for those that don't know, E is the E with a little accent over it. I forget what it's called. I used to know. It's owned by Jose Andres, who is the famous Spanish chef. I want to go to because Haleo I love. It's tapas. It's great. It's basically full price for very little portions. But it's 10 times that. It must have been an amazing experience.
It's supposed to be like a chef's table type thing, right? It's just like 10 of you in this little room. It was like Cirque du Soleil. It was theater. It was food. It was the whole thing. Well, I loved it.
They only have two seatings per day. The first of the month, they send it out where people can make reservations. So you can only do it like that first day of the month, and it's for 2 or 3 months from now. It's going to be $500 if you want the whole experience.
Yeah. To this day, I still talk about it. Like, I'll bring it up to people and just I'll start to describe the meal. It's 24 courses or something. And it was just amazing.
That is amazing, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, what an experience. Next time you come out to Vegas, we'll definitely have to connect, or next time I'm in Florida, we'll have to do the same thing. So what's coming up for Will, for Guillermo, Bill?
Memo.
Memo.
Oh, Memo. I'm starting to travel again. In fact, like right before I got on with you, I was starting to finalize plans for a week-long workshop in New York. That'll be happening. Of course, I teach here year-round in Florida. I'm going to be going down to Colombia and South America to teach in October. So all that to say that the touring part of my work is starting to pick up. Those workshops are in improv, they're in sketch writing, and they're in storytelling. Those are like my three main things. But I also do a lot of work. Thank you. I do a lot of stuff outside of that as well that I get hired in for. One of the big ones is workplace conflict mediation. I'm really big into giving people the tools to communicate better in the workplace. So that's another set of my workshops. Probably the one that is closest to my heart is my work in Alzheimer's and dementia and working with patients and caregivers. All of these workshops come from the root of improvisation. And even in the Alzheimer's and dementia, I did two things. I do one that's what we call brain games, where I'll go into memory care centers or assisted living centers, and I'll do workshops with the residents. It's like fitness. It's cognitive fitness. It's working their brains a little bit. And then I also work with the people who take care of them and teach them the tools, especially like when somebody's going through an Alzheimer's episode where they've gone into this altered reality for a little bit, giving these caregivers the improv tools to follow them and play along while these people are going through their episodes. But this person is ill, they're dying, and why fight them when they are in a happy memory? If they're in a happy memory, why fight them and try to drag them out of it? Instead, live in there with them for a little bit. And they'll come out of it. They always do, for that little moment. Be there with them.
Oh, yeah. Round of applause, man. Thank you. You're doing God's work, man. That is fantastic. What's the name of the organization, or is there someplace that people can contribute or help?
My workshops are now independent. I teach them either independently through me or through my theater, Florida Studio Theater. The original organization that I helped found out of the Boston area is called Healing Moments. Healing Moments does a lot of the workshops that I just described. They also interweave a spirituality aspect to it. They're now based out of Iowa. I still work with them to help develop workshops. But so I'll sometimes work through them, but a lot of this work now, especially living in Florida, which has a very heavy retired population, I do a lot of this stuff either hired independently or through Florida Studio Theater.
Wow. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, but she was also bulimic. So we'd have to go, hey, grandma.
Oh, sorry.
That's horrible.
Oh, man. I was like,
maybe I won't do stand up. Never mind.
No, that's a good one. You got to just, once you get in the audience's trust, you put that one in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is Instagram or your website, will-luetta.com? And for those of you that don't know, I think everyone that's here on Fireside already knows you can go right to that fortune cookie right below us and you can click on that and you'll see my website, paulvato.com. You will also see will-luetta.com. So please find Will. What's your Instagram where people can follow you and do for Instagram or Twitter, or do you have any?
Either one. I check them both regularly. It's at W Luetta at everything from Instagram and Twitter to Pinterest. It'll always be at W Luetta.
Oh, and Chris wants people to know that no cigars were harmed in the making of this podcast. This is amazing. Do you have anything that you'd like to promote? Anything? Are you going to go on tour soon, or what do you have coming up?
Yeah, other than those few dates, the rest of my schedule is starting. I'm finally able to start to project and plan out in advance. So all of those dates will start to pop up on my website. But I'm hoping to do some stuff on the West Coast, in the Texas area, Chicago, Northeast, and Florida. So it'll all start once the schedule comes together, it'll all be on my website.
Pick me up in Las Vegas and I'll hit the road with you, especially to Colombia. My brother's married to a Colombian from Barranquilla. So
yes,
I've been wanting to go to Colombia. But are you teaching improv in Spanish, or are the classes in English? How does that work when you go to South America or Latin America to teach improv?
Yeah, in Latin America, the classes are in Spanish. And it's thankfully, now that I live here in Florida, I speak a lot more Spanish than I did when I was in Boston. But it's still a workout. I don't know if you're like me, where the Spanish I learned was at home. So it's very conversational. It's not academic at all. And I've had to learn a lot of the more advanced, I don't even say advanced, but yeah, advanced words to be able
technical.
To teach effectively.
Yeah,
technical words. To be able to teach effectively. But yeah, when I'm in Latin America, those classes are all in Spanish.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Do you speak Portuguese? Have you learned Portuguese?
I'm getting better at it. And thankfully, I am able to hear it often, which helps. I'm able to hear it quite a bit and put it into practice. Like whenever I get to the Portuguese lesson on Duolingo, I'll go sit next to my wife so that she could either laugh at me or correct me as I'm going through it.
I would love to learn folk.
Yeah.
The COVID helped me with my Italian. So I really brushed up on my Italian and a little bit of Russian. I was trying to learn a little bit of Arabic and Norwegian, but really, I think I'll stick to the Italian. But I would love to learn Portuguese. All the Romance languages would be something to learn.
I've been doing a little bit of the Russian and Arabic and Duolingo as well. The letters, I've really found the letter system in Arabic to be fascinating. I've really enjoyed learning that whole part of the language.
The first day I was like, the first few hours, I was like, this is impossible. There's absolutely no way that I could ever figure this out. No. Impossible. And then it starts clicking and you just start phonetically pronouncing the words. And then sometimes like garage, it's the same. It's almost garage or something. You're oh, okay. And then you're just basically reading from right to left and phonetically sounding the words out. And you surprise yourself when you're like, oh, that's pronounced, that's a K-A, that's K-A. And then all of a sudden it starts clicking. So that's amazing. I like the gamification that Duolingo helps. But also Norwegian, you've been
Not Norwegian, Russian.
Russian.
That has been tough. Those letters, because they don't, I don't know when they're going to cover the alphabet, because they have not covered, I'm about a couple of months into it, and they have not covered the alphabet yet, which I found interesting. In Arabic, they hit the alphabet right away.
Instantly. I was hoping I would just learn it, just like with Russian or anything else, that I would just learn Arabic and start speaking it, because I know a few words like Kifalak, Mazboot, Wayez. Kifalak's hi, how are you? So I was just, and then nothing. It's all reading. I'm like, oh my God, this is impossible. But I took Russian in college, so I do know the alphabet. And so I can decipher. When I see something written, I'm like, oh, F-A. So I can read that alphabet, but it's understanding what people are saying, especially when they're native speakers.
Yeah, and I wish, it's really, I'm sure there's method to all of this, but it's even with the Chinese one on Duolingo, they don't give you the alphabet. They're just like throwing sounds at you. And I'm sure there's a reason for that. You got to be able to think sounds down first.
But that is interesting that Russian just gives you the words that you're learning, but then Arabic goes right in with the alphabet. So yeah, there's got to be a reason, a method to their madness.
So funny. Yeah. I'm convinced that we are alternate versions of ourselves, or we're related in some way, because all the similarities are fascinating.
There's CrossFit Will and then there's Lazy Paul. So
okay, the alternate versions. They got it. Yeah, we're like inverse.
Yeah. You know what? If we go back far enough, I mean, we're related somehow. We've led such parallel lives with the improv. Yeah. I mentioned that I interviewed Kelly Leonard, who used to run, and Jonathan Pitt, who had put together the Chicago Improv Festival. That's the podcast I just put up today. I interviewed him July 1st, but I just put the podcast up. And a lot of these similar things came up.
Yeah, so, funny. Now, is your mother also from Monterrey?
She was born in Harlingen, raised in McAllen, but her mom, my grandmother, one that was bulimic with Alzheimer's, she was from
Monterrey.
Her family was from, but my mom was born in Texas. So she's not Mexican. She's not American. She's Texan.
She's Texan. Yeah. That is funny. Okay. Yeah. So your mom was like what my father was. My father was on the border and my mother was born in Monterrey. Okay.
It's, the opposite. So my dad was born in Monterrey, in a little town called Doctor Gonzalez, which I think now is probably part of Monterrey, because Monterrey just grew exponentially that I believe they've swallowed up these little towns and villages. But he came from a family of 13 kids, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. My mother was a family of 11. One died as a baby, so 12. Yeah.
Same. You know what? I think it was exactly the same, or I think 13, but one died. So they were right there. And it was all girls. There were like three boys, the rest girls, and I think one or two died at birth.
Wow.
I'm
like looking up Dr. Gonzalez. That's the name of it?
Yeah, Dr. Gonzalez.
Municipality.
I love geography. I should have looked it up.
As of right now, I see where it's at. So it is up towards you know what? That's so weird. Dr. Gonzalez is, that's got to be like just a few kilometers of where my mother was from.
Okay.
And here, I'm gonna do a little map. They're like on the same, there's one carretera. There's Dr. Gonzalez, Suasua, and Cienega de Flores, which is where my mom's from.
Amazing. All right. We don't want to bore people with this.
With our geography lesson. That is crazy.
For those of you that love geography, my joke is, for those of you that love geometry, but for those of you that like geography, there is a great website. It's like Wordle, but spelled Worldle. And it'll show you the outline of a country, and you have to guess what country that is. And of course, the U.S., you pick out right away Australia, Canada, Russia, China. But then when it gets, I usually guess Africa first, because there's so many countries in Africa. And then from there, it'll point in the direction where it is and how many kilometers.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
I think you enjoy that. So I don't know if I finished telling you though, but then I worked at Fermilab also. I don't know if I actually...
I don't think you got to that. Okay.
I think before I went to college, or maybe it was the summer after college, but yeah, I worked for one summer at Fermilab, where my dad had for many years. Do you still have a little bit of time? Because we have a speaker request, Mr. Chris Rossetti, who's been harassing us the whole time, would like to come up and maybe ask you a question.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And the answer is 37 kilometers from where your father grew up and my mother grew up.
That's like what, 10 miles?
Yeah, it's very close. That is nuts.
That is
amazing. Wow. Okay. I wonder if they knew each other.
Chris, I'm here.
Video.
I'd like to, everyone, please, would like to welcome Mr. Chris Rossetti to the stage. I don't know if you'd like to come on camera or not, Chris, but welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul and Will. Both of you have provided a great interview today. I enjoy all of your guests, Paul, but this one has to have a follow-up. You two have got to get together, and we've got to see the DNA test results. We've got to see the road trip to the cities. We've got to see you retrace the path up to Chicago and back down to the border. We've got to see all of this come to fruition, because these are not coincidences. I'm telling you, this has been amazing. I have one quick question, and I'll go back to the audience. Will, would you ever consider opening up your own improv club and all the headaches that come with that and rewards that come with that? I'm just curious about that. Thank you so much, guys.
Chris, thank you, Chris. That's a great question. And the answer is yes. I would love that. I have been lucky to, I've worked for some amazing organizations, given some great opportunities to run these improv theaters. But what I'll often say is that I'm really good at making money for other people. So like these theaters that I've worked at, the one in Boston, when I was first brought on, we were making $250,000 a year. By the time I left, it was like $2.5 million. We were nearing $3 million a year by the time I left. Here in Florida, the same thing. I've been able to grow out the program. I was actually supposed to move back up to the Northeast to run another couple of theaters, but that, well, due to COVID, that didn't work out. But I would love, yeah. The thing is, I'm even in all those circumstances, as thankful as I am for those opportunities, I am working for somebody else. I'm in a way executing someone else's vision through my own ideas. But it would be great to have like full, like just control of the space and execute it the way I wanted to. Yes, the answer is yes. I accept. Well,
you let Chris and I handle the ownership of the club, and you don't worry your pretty little face. You just do all the work.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, you don't worry about making money for us. Please, don't worry. My friend Vaughn Papanicholas, who's slightly Greek, Papanicholas, just texted me that I think they want to see more of us. And I'm thinking that we should do a crowd show. I think they're suggesting it. Go to Dr. Gonzalez, go to the town that your mom grew up, but let's do a road trip. Let's go.
I would love that, man. Like, I'm looking at it right now, and the airport's like in between both of our towns, that Aeropuerto de Monterrey. There's Dr. Gonzalez, there's El Aeropuerto, and there's Cienega de Flores. We meet up at the airport, and we start there.
That's why private, though.
Yeah.
And another thing is, both of our fathers, very famous boxers, they would box lettuce, tomato.
That's great. That's a good one. That's your closer right there, Paul.
You might not know this, but my father was a very famous boxer. All right. Help me with my stand-up. My long-lost brother, it is such a pleasure to finally reconnect after all these years. I'm sure we hung out in Chicago back in the 1900s. Great to and see your success, and you're going to have to... But if you need help in Colombia, I'm your guy. Or when you come out to Vegas, please stay as well if you don't want to stay in the hotels.
I appreciate it, Paul. And yeah, there's a lot of, in addition to Colombia, we could chat if you're genuinely interested. There's a lot of Latin American opportunities and different festivals and stuff like that happen. The festivals down there function a little different from the ones up here because they're a lot more, they're big events. They'll put you up, they'll feed you every day. You are working every day. You're doing some sort of show every day. But it's great.
If you want to maybe even add the whole stand-up side to it, I interviewed Richard Villa on my podcast, and he's an amazing stand-up. We had great connections with the Latino community and specifically with Mexican stand-up. So I don't know if we ever do something that involves improv and stand-up and comedy, it would be another great resource. Whether he's available or not, I don't know.
But that's great. Yeah, that's a good conversation to start. We could put a whole package together.
Know that it would probably do well. I'm friends with Johnny Jimenez, who, I don't know if you ever watch Pawn Stars. He's the toy expert. He owns a business called Toy Shack. And he goes down there for toy events, for Comic Cons and toy events down in Mexico or Latin America. And what you said, it was very similar, where they treat you so well. They put you up. They feed you. And they're, I don't know if they're starving for this content, but it's, I think there's something there.
Agreed. That's great, man. Yeah. Let's follow up on that idea. I think it's awesome. There's something there.
You got it, my friend. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up, and anything you'd like to promote, please share any of your final thoughts.
First of all, Chris, thank you for the question. That was a great question. And again, got me thinking down that path, because I would love to do that someday. And I love the travel show, or yeah, whether it's a show or just continuing to discuss it, look up our facts and share with each other. I think that's awesome as well. And yeah, a lot of the stuff that I do, everything from like the Alzheimer's work to workplace mediation to improv, it's all on my website at will-aware. And if people want to reach out, any follow-up questions, if you're going to be in the area in Sarasota, drop me a line. It's all there on my website.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Will, thank you so much for spending the time. Chris, thank you. And everyone in the audience, thanks for the applause. Thanks for the feedback and for sharing the show. Thank you so much. Juan, out there on Facebook or wherever you're watching, thank you for joining us. His father was my mentor, Nicholas Papa Nicholas, who had a great coffee company. So when I owned my ice cream shop, I used to own an Oberweis dairy, and Nick was one of my customers and became my friend and mentor. It's always great to think of Nicholas Papa Nicholas. Passed away a long time ago, but he was in my heart. And I just want to thank everyone. Please go to paulvato.com so that you can follow us across all. Most importantly, get that uncle to Apple Podcast and leave us a review, give us a follow, and also on
Spotify.
And I'm building my team. But what was picked up today? Find the podcast. Big news, we just broke top 10 of independent comedy improv podcasts on Good Pollen. So we're at 9. And
it's all the other podcast.
We're like in the 12th place. So if you guys could go over there and give it a
I'd like to get
it
to the top 10.
I'm the regular, not just the indie, but
from all queens.
Thank you, Will, for being part of this journey.
Thank you, Paul. This was fantastic. Thank you.
You got it, my friend. And so, once again, thank you guys for being here.
Whether you're here or on the live stream.
And thank you all. And let's do this again, Will.
Yeah. Then follow up. Not for
you. Got it, man. Let's take it. My.
Y ese hombre holding up the bottle. Look a little closer, cigar in Moscato. An actor in improv coming from Chicago. Alto, make way for Paul Vato. Pablo C.